In his latest biography, Ron Chernow offers a cradle-to-grave account of the life of George Washington, perhaps the most enigmatic leader in U.S. history. Mr. Chernow visited our show last month to discuss Washington a Life, and we thought that we would re-air that interview during this holiday weekend. I started off by asking him, isn't this something of a departure for you? Your biographies have been about the titans of finance, and even the Alexander Hamilton book was largely about his role in establishing an economic framework in the early days of U.S. history. But Washington wasn't a man of finance.
You're absolutely right. And let me explain, because this is the first book that does not have a significant financial or economic dimension. I had done a whole series of books on moguls of the Gilded Age. And I remember after I published the Rockefeller book, Titan, I would finish a speech and people in the audience would start yelling out, do Carnegie next, do Vanderbilt next, as if I would spend the rest of my life knocking off one mogul after another. I'm obviously very interested in business and finance, but I'm also interested in politics and society. So I was very happy to escape from that.
And I'm assuming that your last biography on Alexander Hamilton led you to Washington, a natural progression?
It led quite directly, because one day I was reading a series of letters that Hamilton wrote about Washington after they had a quarrel during the Revolutionary War, and Hamilton quit Washington's staff as aide-de-camp. And he sits down and he writes a letter to his father-in-law explaining his decision. And he describes Washington as very moody and irritable and temperamental. And he writes, as only a young man can, the general shall for once repent his ill humor. And I could remember being stunned by that description, ill humor. This did not seem to square with the saintly image of George Washington that I had. And that really led me down this very long road in terms of figuring out who Washington was.
Although they had a bumpy relationship over the years, they worked together.
They worked together brilliantly because they complemented each other. Hamilton was an original political theorist, had this extraordinary programmatic mind. Washington was a very smart man, and he was wonderful at latching on to other people's ideas and then activating it. So Washington had the judgment, the courage, the patriotism. Hamilton had the brilliance.
When you began, did you imagine it would run around 900 pages? This is the longest single-volume biography ever written about Washington.
Well, I have to say, Leonard, you know, the books that I really had in mind, Douglas Southall Freeman back in the 40s and 50s did 7 volumes, 4,000 pages. James T. Flexner did 4 volumes, 2,000 pages. I feel this one clocks in at 904 pages. I felt like I was writing it on the back of a postage stamp.
It's a novella. I ran into you when you were still working on the book, and you told me that one of your goals was to dispel some of the myths about Washington. We know, obviously, that he didn't chop down that cherry tree, but what are some of the other myths that historians have promulgated over the years?
I think the big myth in the mind of the American public is that he was this very, you know, worthy, but that he was a bland and even kind of a boring figure, that he inspires respect. He doesn't inspire excitement or affection. And what I discovered when I was doing the Hamilton book was that Washington's contemporaries saw him as this very charismatic and dynamic figure. So I really wanted to resurrect that figure, not the stiff, craggy Gilbert Stuart figure, but that kind of, you know, very lithe, athletic, magnetic figure.
Well, I remember one biographer, Rick Brookhiser, he said that Washington was a big man with a John Wayne-like physique. Was that true?
Yeah, although one thing that I discovered was always said in biographies he was 6'2" or 6'3". I can state with certainty that he was only 6 feet tall. And I say that, Leonard, because before the Revolutionary War, every 6 months he wrote a letter to his tailor in London and described himself as a man exactly 6 feet tall. So he can retire the 6'2", 6'3". He was larger than life, however.
Is it true that he had a near obsession with his personal appearance?
Near obsession with his personal appearance and even with the appearance of people around him. One of the most surprising and amusing discoveries was that during the Revolutionary War, he created his own personal guard. And he specified that every member of his personal guard could not be shorter than 5'9" or taller than 5'10". He wanted them to have this kind of, you know, bandbox brilliance and perfection, very concerned with appearances.
So there were a lot of tall guys in early America. I always thought that was something that came later when we all drank milk.
That's a good point, because when I was doing Hamilton, Hamilton was about 5'6", 5'7", but he was always described as kind of slight and of middling height. So apparently there were more tall people than we imagined.
Now, Washington, we've heard a lot about his dental problems. He had only one original tooth by the time he became
president. Yeah, he had this brave lower left bicuspid that had to anchor both the upper and lower dentures. The teeth turned out to be very important because what I discovered was that those upper and lower dentures were connected in the back by these curved metal springs. Every time he opened his mouth, it relaxed the pressure on the springs, and there was always the possibility that the dentures would come flying out. I think, Leonard, is the reason that as president, Washington's speeches were often only one, two, three paragraphs long.
And why we always see him with his lips compressed.
With his lips, particularly in the later pictures, yes.
He also suffered from many physical ailments that were concealed from the public.
During the first year or two of his presidency, he nearly died twice. He had an infection, a carbuncle on his thigh. They thought at the time it might be a form of anthrax. Then a year later, he has flu or pleurisy that develops into pneumonia. Both times, the executive mansion, which was then in New York, was sealed off to the public, and they sprinkled straw in the streets so that there wouldn't be any noise to disturb the president. And both times, Washington, who had a very hardy constitution, rallied. But, of course, there was no provision in the Constitution or the government for someone to step in and replace an ailing president.
Was that the main concern, or was it also that he wanted to present himself as a man who was always in good health?
Well, I think that Washington, it's interesting. By the time that he was 30 years old, he had survived smallpox, malaria, and dysentery. I was struck by the fact Washington
malaria?
Died, malaria. And in fact, the malaria kept recurring throughout his life. It's very difficult to get rid of it. Washington dies at 67. We are all accustomed to thinking of people in the 18th century dying at around age 50. But actually, Washington, who dies at 67, is one of the shorter-lived of the early presidents. Most of his next four or five successors, all with one exception, lived till 80, in the case of John Adams, till 90. The reason being, there were so many epidemics in the 18th century. If you could survive them, if you could hit 50, you were probably off and running to 70 or 80.
Getting back to that whole image of him as somebody who's kind of dispassionate and aloof kind of door, he was an actor, wasn't he? Didn't he like to act?
Well, he had a tremendous sense of political theater and stagecraft. In fact, we put on the cover of the book Washington on a White Horse for a reason. When Washington was traveling between towns, he traveled by coach. He would dismount from the coach. He always brought along one or two white parade horses, and then he would mount the white parade horse and go into town on the horse. So that this was a man who had a real kind of genius for projecting the heroic image that he wanted.
My guest is Ron Chernow, whose latest book is Washington, A Life. It is published by Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Pretty much every review starts off with the fact that there have been so many books written about Washington, and pretty much every document has been poured over more than once. Did that present a certain challenge for you?
It presented a challenge, but I wasn't deterred for the following reason. These kind of great multi-volume monumental biographies of generations past that I felt I was going up against had been based on a much smaller edition of his papers. The old edition was based on 17,000 documents. The new edition is based on 135,000 documents. So we know not only know more about George Washington than his own contemporaries, I dare say we know more about George than Martha. We know in that kind of detail.
Let's talk about Martha. He was in love with another woman when he met her.
That's right. He was in love with Sally Fairfax, and right on the eve of his engagement to Martha, which was kind of whirlwind engagement, he writes a letter to Sally that can only be interpreted as a declaration of love. She rather coyly rebukes him and sidesteps him, and he goes on with the marriage to Martha. I don't think that the marriage to Martha was a particularly lusty or torrid affair, but I think that it was a deep friendship and I think absolutely essential to his career.
Well, she was a very wealthy woman. That never hurts. Did he bring money to the marriage?
George Washington was already well-to-do, but Martha Dandridge Custis, as she was then known, was a young widow in her late 20s. She owned 18,000 acres outside of Williamsburg. She owned 300 slaves. So George Washington, who had been born not poor but into second-tier gentry and had dreamed of entering to first-tier gentry, suddenly with the marriage to Martha, he is catapulted into that, highest stratum of Virginia society.
She was a widow with two children of her own. Did Washington want his own children?
They did. And in fact, it's presumed because Martha had four children from the previous marriage, two of whom had died in childhood. It has always been assumed that George Washington was sterile. And I discovered, Leonard, that Washington's sterility, as strange as this sounds, was extremely important in his career for two reasons. Number one, a lot of religiously minded people said that God had denied him his own biological children so that he could be father of the country. Two, when he became president and there was constant fear of a reversion to monarchy, people said, oh, Washington would have no interest in hereditary aristocracy or nobility because he has no heirs. So it worked to his advantage.
Would he have? Do you, considering the fact that he only served two terms and then decided not to continue when he obviously could have, Do you have the sense that there was no Kim Jong-il in the story?
No. In fact, I was surprised to discover that when he decided to stand for president, I say stand, the office was his. He was actually unanimously elected by the Electoral College. But he was so glutted with fame and power at that point that he agreed to become president, and he said that he would serve only for a year or two and establish the legitimacy of the new government and step down. Then there was one crisis after another where his cabinet said, you can't leave in the middle of this crisis, and he served for two terms. But I don't think that he was particularly happy as president.
But I get the feeling that he has served the same kind of role that Nelson Mandela has served more recently, in that he could have really messed this whole thing up. Instead, because he had a certain amount of integrity,
Absolutely.
He didn't.
Yeah. No, the interesting thing is, you know, he starts out at the beginning of the book, you'll see, he's really in many ways an unattractive character. He's interested in money, status, and power, you know, feathering his own nest. And then what happens is at the time of the Stamp Act and then later the Intolerable Acts, all of his personal grievances against the British Empire, they denied him a royal commission, they sent him shoddy, overpriced goods from London. All of these personal grievances are suddenly and rather gloriously transmuted into abstract political causes, and then a whole different personality emerges.
You don't paint his mother in the most flattering light.
You're putting it
okay, a scathing portrait of her.
No, Mary Ball Washington, let me put it this way, the mother of the father of the country, we don't have a single sentence from her where she expresses any pride or pleasure in her son. She doesn't attend the wedding of George and Martha Washington. She never visits them at Mount Vernon. And in fact, she always claimed that she was being neglected by George. There's an extraordinary incident towards the end of the Revolutionary War where George Washington gets a letter from Richmond, the Virginia state capital, saying that his mother has been there for 2 months, filing a petition for emergency relief, claiming poverty, and intimating that her son, the commander-in-chief, has abandoned her. And I have to say, he was a very dutiful and generous son, but he got precious little in return.
But he continued to care for her despite.
Yes, he did. It was very kind of, you know, very frosty, very, very correct. But I say in the book that the first great general that George Washington encountered was his mother.
What about his relationship with his siblings? His brothers were sent to Europe to be educated. He wasn't.
Yeah, you know, there are two families because his father marries twice. George reveres his older half brother Lawrence. Lawrence marries into the Fairfax family, which is the most powerful family in Virginia, and this opens all sorts of doors socially and politically for George. That brother Lawrence dies at 34, and then George is following a script that has already been written by Lawrence. So that's the significant early relationship.
But he's the only founding father who didn't go to college.
That's right. And in fact, he referred to his defective education. And there was always a certain kind of anxiety and self-consciousness. The nice thing about Washington is that he was not afraid to surround himself with people more brilliant than he was. So his first cabinet, which is only three members, his Secretary of Treasury is Alexander Hamilton. His Secretary of State is Thomas Jefferson. Need I say more?
Well, in fact, Douglas, a listener, left a question on our show page whether Washington thought about his cabinet in the way that Lincoln did as a team of rivals, because Hamilton and Jefferson surely were rivals.
It's an amazing story because Jefferson actually, like President Obama, becomes president wanting to have a reasonable, nonpartisan discourse, and it doesn't happen. And during Washington's first term, not only does the two-party system emerge, it emerges from within his own cabinet. Hamilton on the one hand, and Jefferson on the other, and Washington, instead of saying to one or the other, "You'll have to leave," and we have to have greater uniformity of opinion, he actually likes having that kind of diversity of opinion.
That diversity of opinion, in a way, stimulated him.
Yeah, I think so. He certainly was not afraid of it. In fact, he was afraid, really, of having that kind of monolithic opinion. He did not want to be surrounded by people.
Well, that means he was a good leader.
He was an excellent leader.
Did he write his own speeches, or did he have other people do it the way presidents do?
Both. But when he had to, do his own writing, it was extraordinarily eloquent. You know, a lot of people have been asking me recently, what would Washington say about the mosque? And I keep quoting his famous letter to the—
Now, why would people ask you that? I always wonder about these things where we wonder what the founding fathers would have said about things that they could never have imagined.
I know. But in this case, actually, I welcome the question because one of Washington's great virtues was his sense of religious freedom and tolerance. And he wrote to the Jewish congregation in Newport, Rhode Island, that was concerned whether Jews would, retain their civil liberties. He said, happily, the government of the United States, which gives to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance, requires only that those who live under its protection should acquit themselves honorably as citizens. It's a great line, and he wrote that.
You wrote a very nice op-ed piece about the insistence of some people today on asking what would the founding fathers say about all sorts of things that they could not have imagined.
Now, and ordinarily it drives me crazy when people say, what would the founders have thought? Because I say, which founders on which issue? Mm-hmm. These were the most argumentative, opinionated people.
And does Antonin Scalia know that?
I don't know. I mean, I'm a
skeptic. Tea Party people are talking as though there was a kind of a unified bunch of opinions among the founders.
And the amazing thing is the Constitutional Convention no sooner ended than the entire country was debating the meaning of it, including the people who had attended and signed the Constitution. In fact, during the ratification process, Hamilton and Madison team up to write the Federalist Papers. Then they become the two great adversaries, Madison arguing the strict construction side, Hamilton arguing for much more liberal and expansive interpretation of the Constitution. So, the originalists, there's this sort of notion that everyone agreed as to the meaning of the Constitution, where it was really up for grabs from the beginning.
My guest is Ron Chernow, who has written a number of prize-winning books, The House of Morgan, which won the National Book Award, also Alexander Hamilton and Titan, The Life of John D. Rockefeller Sr., and now Washington, A Life, which is published by the Penguin Press. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with an interview I did with Ron Chernow in October. He'd abandoned the world of finance as a subject for his latest biography, Washington, A Life. One of the things we talked about was Mr. Chernow's revelation that George Washington was actually somewhat careless in managing his own money.
No, it's amazing because it's always said that he was the richest or one of the richest people in the United States at the time. But what I discovered was that he had to borrow money to go to his own inauguration. He then had to borrow money to go back to Mount Vernon at the end of his second term. In the case of someone who was land rich and clearly slave rich, but always seemed to be cash poor, and he always talked poor.
That's despite the fact that Martha had so much money that they
run
through it.
Yes, one of the things that George Washington, finally comes to a very strong principled opposition to slavery, and in fact, in his will, he frees those 124 slaves who were under his direct legal control. But long before that, he comes to a conclusion that slavery is not only immoral, but it's unprofitable. He feels kind of oppressed and trapped in that system because he feels he's giving them food and board and medical care, but they really don't have any incentive to work hard. And Washington was a man of a very powerful work ethic, and he kind of had a blind spot because he's frustrated that he can't improve the productivity of the slaves. There was no earthly reason why the slaves should work harder.
Well, he could have paid them a salary.
Well, but, that was really there wasn't that kind of free labor market in Virginia.
Well, he freed the slaves under his control, but not all the slaves, because he didn't want to leave Martha impoverished.
Well, he wanted her to have the benefit of the income. I should explain, there were 300 slaves, 124 were under Washington's direct legal control. The remainder were so-called dower slaves that Martha had brought to the marriage that were pledged to the Custis heirs. Now, Washington thought through the freeing of his slaves in great detail. He just missed one glaring thing, which was that when he died, the will was published. All the slaves at Mount Vernon knew whether they were one of George's slaves or one of Martha's slaves. The 124 who were Georgia slaves, every time they looked at Martha Washington, thought, the second that lady dies, I'm a free person. She was so unnerved by that situation that a year after George died, Martha freed those slaves. She just couldn't bear it.
But they weren't opposed to slavery. They just had, it seems to me to be an odd, eccentric view of slavery. I'm assuming that people in the South, slave owners and people who freed their slaves, represented a wide spectrum of opinion.
Yeah, they did. You know, and the thing is that so many of the founders, there were so many people at the time, you know, who in theory were opposed to slavery. After the American Revolution, everybody realized that the principles of the Revolution stood in contradiction to the existence of slavery.
I would have thought Jefferson the most, obviously, because he wrote so.
Jefferson the most, but Jefferson did not free his slaves, and Jefferson was chronically in debt. And so what happened in this very cowardly way, they just kept postponing that and hoping that future generations would legislate it away.
You spend quite a few pages writing about Washington's life as a general. Was this the period that defined him?
Well, inevitably it does. You know, the biographer James T. Flexner came up with the phrase George Washington, the indispensable man, and he really is. There's no other general whom you could sort of pop into Washington's position and come up with the same outcome. And I say that even though I come to the conclusion in the book that Washington was middling at best as a general. He bungled a lot of battles through faulty intelligence or poor strategy. But Washington has the immense political skill and the inspirational qualities and charisma to hold together an army for 8.5 years in the face of shortages of money, manpower, clothing, blankets, shoes, gunpowder. He's dealing with 14 masters, 13 state governments, and the Continental Congress. Nobody else would have had the political skill, both with the politicians and then with his own men, to hold them together.
Wasn't he initially reticent about assuming the position of leader of the Continental Army?
He was. You know, you mentioned earlier the Washington sense of his defective education. Washington did have a lot of insecurities and anxieties. And at every major appointment in his life, he would give a speech that what we would say lower expectations, you know, full of disclaimers. I'm really not equal to this charge. And if it doesn't work out, I warned you now. And some of that was perhaps a studied or false modesty, but some of it reflected a genuine anxiety that he had.
On the other hand, he had a reputation of being rather tough and also for little tolerance for drinkers. Now, didn't he own a large whiskey distillery?
In his final years, he had a distillery at Mount Vernon that was possibly the largest distillery in the country, which is very ironic because he was always on the warpath against alcohol, whether it's his soldiers in the Continental Army or his overseers at Mount Vernon. And even as president, always one of the first things that he wanted to know about somebody was that person a drinker?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's reasonable. Alcoholics don't perform as well.
Yeah, no, that well. But, you know, when people think of Mount Vernon, they think about a tobacco plantation. In addition to having tobacco, corn, wheat, et cetera, Washington had the largest distillery. He had a commercial grist mill. He had an enormous fishery business. They brought up 1 million herring a year out of the Potomac, believe it or not. So this was really almost kind of more like an industrial village than what we think of as a plantation.
You write that he encouraged less privileged newcomers to assume officer positions on the battlefield. Why do you suppose he did that?
He was a great talent scout. You know, he plucks Henry Knox, who had been a Boston bookseller, who becomes his chief of artillery and a great success, or Nathaniel Green, who was this, you know, limping asthmatic guy from Rhode Island, who from a Quaker family, and they become brilliant successes. What I show in the book is that George Washington often, with his age peers, felt very keen competition. He has much better relations in his lives with people of the older generation or the younger generation. So for instance, it's not coincidental, he has a wonderful relationship with Franklin, who's a generation older, and with Madison and Hamilton, who are a generation younger. He feels a much greater rivalry with Adams and Jefferson, who were somewhat closer age peers.
Although Adams winds up becoming his vice president.
But really excluded from the inner council.
Was that the beginning of the vice presidential job being really the job where you put the person who you wanted to get rid of?
Except that under the rules in force at the time, every person in the Electoral College had two votes. The person who got the most votes was president, and then the second most vice president. So that there wasn't yet the idea of a ticket. But
this is what led to the problem with Aaron Burr later.
That's right, exactly. But it was John Adams who made the famous statement that the job of vice president was, I forget what it was, the most ludicrous ever invented or useless ever invented by the mind of man.
You mentioned that he wasn't a great general. By the end of his military career, Washington had lost more battles than he won. Was this something that his contemporaries noticed?
Oh, there was an enormous amount of criticism of him. In fact, you know, by the fall of 1777, it's Horatio Gates who wins the famous victory at Saratoga. Washington has suffered a series of disastrous defeats at Brandywine Creek in Germantown, and there's an enormous amount of discussion about replacing him. But everyone, you know, Leonard, at the time, you have to remember, there was only the Continental Congress. There was not only no independent judiciary, there was no executive branch. Washington was as close as we had to a single leader. And so his role as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army was as much political as military. And politically, he was absolutely brilliant and faultless.
And when he became president, was he politically brilliant?
I think so, yeah. You know, he forges the office of the presidency. There was really no mention of the constitution of a cabinet. He creates it. He staffs it with brilliant people, Hamilton, Jefferson, et al. You know, most importantly, the framers of the Constitution thought that it was going to be the Congress that would be the engine of government, Congress being the people's house. Washington realized that it would have to be the president who would spearhead domestic and foreign policy. So we're really living still with Washington's presidency.
Well, the Constitution talked about separation of powers, but from the start, there was jockeying for position, wasn't there?
Well, Washington, you know, Washington.
Except the Supreme Court was the weakest at that moment.
Yeah, the Supreme Court was only six people. Comically, Washington gets, I think, the first four appointees, or maybe even first or six, fly through in 48 hours. Very different era from now. But Washington is very dutiful in following the Constitution, and it says for treaties, he needs the advice and consent of the Senate. So they're negotiating a treaty with the Creek Indians. He goes to to the Senate, and it's very noisy. They keep rereading these papers, then they decide to commit them to a committee, and Washington stands up in a huff, and he says, this defeats every purpose of my coming here. And so Washington effectively decides to trim advice and consent to just consent. So there was already a dysfunctional Congress.
Well, and this is how the traditions of our political system were developed.
Yeah, this is really through trial and error, and you know, it didn't make any sense that a body as large as the House or the Senate was going to shape policy.
Do you think that if he were alive today, looking at what's going on in Washington, that I mean, with all of the obvious differences, that he would kind of recognize the same?
I think the fact that
political
the country
atmosphere?
Became strong and powerful, he would recognize. The fact that
– the partisanship?
The fact that things are nasty and partisan, he more than anyone would not be surprised by because he dealt with that in his own time, much to his own chagrin. I think that would disappoint and surprise him was the low caliber of a lot of the people in public life because he did live in a time of philosopher kings, however vicious or partisan they were. But this kind of world of pollsters and focus groups and – PACs and lobbyists, that I think would be quite abhorrent to him.
I say one of the big problems with writing a biography is that you kind of have to fall in love with your subject. Is that what happened with you in Washington?
Yeah, I don't know if I fell in love with him. I take a very kind of long and cold and searching look at him as a slaveholder. I found that he could often be, you know, manic about money. I try not to sweep anything under the rug, but I do think that it ends up as a very, very admiring portrait. But I feel that if you're going to do an admiring portrait, Leonard, the only way to do it is you have to establish your credibility as a biographer by convincing the reader that you have not withheld a single fact. And there are some things in here, particularly with Washington and slavery, that people are going to gag on.
Well, he was friendly with at least one of the slaves, but did he cross the line the way Jefferson did?
No. Again, since it's thought he was sterile, we wouldn't know. But I don't think that happened. No, let me just give you an
example. There weren't rumors. Rumors during Jefferson's lifetime.
Well, in fact, Jefferson's relationship with Sally Hemings was actually exposed during Jefferson's first term as president. So there was a lot of scuttlebutt then and since. Now, let me give you an example with Washington and the slaves. After he comes back from the war, he writes in his diary that it was the coldest winter on record in Virginia. It's so cold, he said, it's too cold for him to go out and ride his horse. And he was a very rugged character. Yet he's checking in with all the five overseers at his five farms to make sure that all the slaves are out working in the coldest winter on record. And they're doing very, very heavy manual labor, draining swamps, pulling up tree stumps. And I read that and my heart sank. It's hard to imagine any human being not saying, let's give the slaves a day off or a short day or whatever. But
was he that way when he was a general? Because he did have a reputation for being a bit callous as well.
Well, he was just, you know, what I found, and this is part of the portrait of him psychologically, he was a fierce and driving perfectionist. This was a very, very demanding person. He was not a person who handed out praise lightly, and people were kind of competing for his favor. He set high, sometimes impossibly high standards.
How did he handle retirement?
With difficulty. Interestingly, you know, he spends his two terms as president trying to resist the partisanship that engulfs the country. And then in his last remaining years, which were just about 3 years, he becomes fiercely partisan, rather rabid and even slightly bitter.
As a Federalist.
As a Federalist, yeah. He finally declares himself.
He comes out
of the closet as a Federalist and begins to use the term.
How influential was Hamilton in determining those sorts of things?
You know, enormously so. But again, sometimes it's thought that Hamilton, you know, manipulated or kind of entranced Washington into doing his bidding. Whereas because they had shared that same experience together during the Continental Army, in terms of what a weak and ineffective Congress means, what it means not to have a powerful, you know, executive, they both felt very strongly about the issue of debt. I think that they worked well together because basically on most political issues they saw eye to eye.
I'm assuming that you've already decided on your next subject.
You know.
Not true? I was going to guess that you'd return to the world of finance.
No, I think that I've left that behind. I wanted to prove to the world that I wasn't a one-trick pony.
Well, those weren't tricks. That was a wide range of subjects.
Yes,
that
I'm glad you said that because there was a lot of politics and society in that too.
And the book is Washington, A Life. It is published by Penguin Press. And Ron, it's been wonderful talking with you again, as it always is.
No book would be complete without a stop here, Leonard.
Thank you so much. On Monday's show, we'll take a look inside Hezbollah and find out why the group draws supporters from every part of Middle Eastern society. Then Richard Cohn looks at our long, complex relationship with the sun. Plus, Steve Martin discusses his latest novel, An Object of Beauty, his take on the art world, and David Owen explains why he thinks Manhattan is, by far, the greenest place in America. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neeshick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Christina Maldonado, Max Bass, and Dan Volpe. Dimitri Krasny was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. I hope you're having a great holiday weekend, and we'll see you on Monday.